it's about power, right? And it's about shifting power relations that gets at the root causes of oppression. And so like there's this growing sector of lawyers and legal organizations who are using their skills to build the power of social movements. And so, you know, instead of viewing themselves as saviors, these lawyers see themselves as really the scaffolding under the feet of, you know, these collectives of organizing people. And so the lawyers creatively use legal tools, you know, to help these organizers build the power, right? And to make the space for, to validate, to bolster, to defend and protect social movements and the activists in the communities within them. Like, we really think this allows lawyers to have a much larger impact.
I'm Ellie Happel, and you're listening to episode 5 of The Other Side of the Water, Immigration and the Promise of Racial Justice. Episode 4 of the series explored anti-blackness experienced by Black immigrants in the era of Donald Trump. Today, we look at how attorneys and organizers work together to challenge racially discriminatory policies. We explore examples that demonstrate how social movements for civil rights, for immigrant rights, and exemplified today by the Movement for Black Lives, are the engines of progress and social change. Our guests are Ninaj Raoul, the co-founder and executive director of Haitian Women for Haitian Refugees, and Sejal Zota, the legal director and co-founder of Just Futures Law. To begin, we return to the 1990s when the U.S. government was interdicting Haitian people at sea and placing them in detention camps on Guantanamo. We look at how attorneys and organizers, including Ninaj, work together to challenge this policy.
I'm Ninaj Raoul. I am a co-founder and executive director of Haitian Women for Haitian Refugees, but I identify as being a community organizer.
Ninaj, the child of Haitian immigrants, moved to New York City from her native Chicago to pursue a career in fashion editorial. Ninaj's work in fashion was short-lived.
It was right after they opened up Guantanamo in late 1991, after the coup in Haiti that overthrew Jean-Bertrand Aristide, the first democratically elected president. And so I responded, and I ended up applying to be a linguist specialist for the Department of Justice. And shortly after, I was flown down to Guantanamo to work for INS, then Immigration and Naturalization Services, that no longer exists, where they were doing credible fear interviews for thousands of Haitians that had come to Guantanamo. And that's how I ended up working with Haitian refugees.
Next tonight, we have an update on the plight of thousands of Haitians trying to flee their country and gain entry to the United States. The key issue is whether they are political refugees or, as the Bush administration argues, trying to escape Haiti's poverty and not eligible for entry into the U.S. They left Haiti in rickety boats, and many were picked up by the U.S. Coast Guard and given temporary refuge at the U.S. base at Guantanamo, Cuba. Correspondent Charles Krauss visited Guantanamo, and here is his report.
There is no joy or thanksgiving among the Haitians in Guantanamo. Only uncertainty and frustration. It could be months before their future is decided by courts in the United States. Meanwhile, the vast tent city erected to house the Haitians grows larger every day. U.S. military authorities here have orders to prepare for up to 10,000 refugees, twice the number already in Guantanamo.
So the Haitian refugees were detained in Guantanamo starting October of 1991, right after the September 30th coup. About 5,000 Haitians were killed immediately by the military in Haiti. And as a result, people that supported the Aristide administration were persecuted and they had to flee. They had no other way of fleeing for most cases. They took boats and left the country. And then they ended up being interdicted by the U.S. Coast Guard.
In 1990, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, a priest and liberation theologist, became Haiti's first democratically elected president. He served for less than 1 year before he was overthrown in a military coup. The years that followed were bloody. Supporters of Aristide were beaten, tortured, and murdered. This led to an increase in outmigration. tens of thousands of Haitian refugees embarked in questionably seaworthy boats to travel the 700-plus miles to South Florida. President Bush authorized the Coast Guard to intercept boats of Haitian men, women, and children and prevent them from reaching U.S. soil. The Coast Guard turned some boats back to Haiti. Others they took to camps set up at Guantanamo. At its peak, the camp held more than 12,000 Haitian people. International refugee law says that people fleeing political persecution may not be returned to the country where they face persecution. Refugees fleeing out of fear have a right to what is called a credible fear interview. If deemed as having a credible fear, the individual may begin the process of applying for asylum. Between October 1991 and June of 1992, asylum officers conducted credible fear interviews of nearly 37,000 Haitian people at Guantanamo Bay.
The credible fear interviews were very arbitrary. They could last anywhere from 15 minutes to 45 minutes. In some cases, the longer ones were similar to the asylum interviews here in the United States. People came by boat, were dehydrated, sick from the journey. Those that made it, they were, well, when they first interdicted by the Coast Guards, many of them brought their belongings with them. And when they were picking them up from the boats, they would throw down the rope ladders. They would tell them to leave their belongings on the boats. They'll get it later. And after they climbed up into the Coast Guard cutter, they would set the boat on fire with all their belongings. So a lot of people lost their papers and documents in the boat. And it was said that that was done because they didn't want the germs or the microbes of the Haitians to be coming in. So they didn't allow them to bring a lot of their belongings. Once they got to Guantanamo, the conditions were horrible. They were put in tents, rows of tents that had rows of cots that were side by side. It was on an open cement field with no trees, so there was no shade to block the sun. I heard somewhere between 400 to 500 different stories from people just from interpreting, and naturally internalized a lot of the trauma that people had gone through. And it was back to back. It was 7 days a week initially, working 12 to 14 hours a day of hearing these horrible stories of people that had lost family members, been persecuted, beaten, many rape cases with the women and girls.
Before Ninaj worked at Guantanamo, her dad, a retired physician, had also served as an interpreter for the detained asylum seekers.
And he eventually left, and he had said that it was the most blatant display of racism that he had ever experienced in his life. And I totally agree with him. The racism was very blatant.
The U.S. government forcibly returned almost 75% of the Haitian people who they interviewed. Haitian asylum seekers faced one of the lowest rates of approval of any nation in the world. Ninaj's experience on Guantanamo led her to co-found Haitian Women for Haitian Refugees.
Haitian Women for Haitian Refugees was initially founded to respond to the needs of the asylum seekers that were fleeing persecution in Haiti and that ended up in Guantanamo. It was founded by a woman named Marie Lily Surratt and myself, and we were both women living in Brooklyn who met in Guantanamo as we were both interpreting for the credible fear interviews. And when we met refugees that were going to be coming back to the Brooklyn area, which were many, some had never even been in Port-au-Prince in their lives. They came from very rural areas of Haiti, very remote areas. So I couldn't even imagine them coming to New York after being in these conditions in the camp for so long. So that's the reason that we shared our phone number and said, you know, let us know if you need anything, if you have any issues when you get there. And over the years, initially we started meeting with the folks that came from Guantanamo, but shortly we started learning that there were many other folks that came in other ways and that were also fleeing persecution. And over the years, we worked with different rounds of Haitian refugees that came in for different reasons. So we were founded in 1992 to respond to the needs of the immigrants that were fleeing persecution.
While Ninaj was interpreting on Guantanamo, the U.S. government set up a special detention camp for refugees who tested HIV positive. It was called Camp Bulkley. It was the world's first detention camp for HIV positive people. More than 300 men, women, and children were detained in Camp Bulkley, some for as long as a year and a half. Ninaja's first in-depth experience as an organizer, working together with lawyers, led to the closure of Camp Bulkley less than 2 years later. Attorney Michael Ratner and his team of Yale law students filed a suit, which in the end shut Camp Bulkley down. The case was called Haitian Centers Council versus SALE. Ninaj.
4 times I went back within 2 months because of the HIV camp, working together with the law students at Yale University. And there were several law firms, too, that were involved. And there was quite a movement. You know, there were rallies and actions in New York asking for the release of these 200 refugees there were and their family members. ACT UP, some of the folks from the movements from before that fought for HIV rights or for rights for HIV positive people, they joined in solidarity and had protests.
The people detained in Camp Bulkley went on hunger strike. Law students and undergraduate students joined them in solidarity. There was an estimated tens of thousands of students in the United States who participated in rallies and protests and called for the camp's closure. In June of 1993, the Yale lawsuit prevailed. By the end of the month, all of the men, women, and children who'd been detained at Camp Bulkley were relocated to New York or Miami. This was the first of many lawsuits and campaigns bolstered by Haitian women for Haitian refugees. Another example of successful organizing and people power years later is the Haitian Refugee Fairness Act, which Congress passed in 1998. The act provided a path for Haitian nationals living in the United States to become permanent residents. It was passed 1 year after NACARA, a similar bill that provided a path to residency for Central American nationals, but it noticeably excluded people from Haiti.
And that was basically an equity issue because NACARA had just passed for many of the Central American immigrants that were here that were out of status. And there was a long fight of about 10 to 12 years for that to pass. And when many of the Haitians from Miami that were undocumented saw that all these Central Americans and even there was a few Eastern Europeans that were covered by it somehow get their permanent residency, they felt left out and really took the streets. You know, and they came out in thousands in front of the governor's office, who was then Jeb Bush. They came out thousands in front of some of the legislator's office. And this was at a time where Jesse Helms was there, and he had already said that he didn't want to see a bill for Haitians on the table. And he had a lot of followers, a lot of racist followers as himself. But nonetheless, the fact that thousands of Haitians took the streets came and stood in front of these legislators' district offices in Miami, this moved them to have to write legislation because no one wants thousands of people in front of their office. There were crowds from 7,000 to 8,000 people that were protesting in front of their office. So it moved them to write some legislation on behalf of Haitians, which eventually passed as Haitian Refugee Immigration Fairness Act in 1998. So in a matter of 1 year, actually, which is really short. And we really pushed it on an equity issue. But despite that, we've had some successes. And as I mentioned, the reason that there even was any legislation is because the thousands of undocumented people took the streets in Miami. And this is why it's important for directly impacted people to be at the forefront of these movements. And had it not been for those people who took the streets because they felt that they were left out of NACARA and they wanted to adjust their status to permanent residency, standing in front of the legislator's office, there wouldn't have been any legislation for the advocates to push through. And that stands true today, too. And once that legislation was written up, they also went and stood in front of Governor Jeb Bush's office, who was the governor of Florida at the time. And just once, they had one huge protest with 8,000 people there. And he wrote a letter of support just because he didn't want 8,000 people standing in front of his office. So had it not been for the people to take the streets, it wouldn't have started. I can give many examples in between. The Haitian refugees in Guantanamo wouldn't have been released when they were in the HIV camp because of the exclusion ban. And litigation also helps, but litigation has to be coupled with grassroots organizing, I think, to be truly effective for a lasting change.
Attorney Sejal Zota agrees. Sejal is the legal director and co-founder of Just Futures Law. Like Ninaj, she is the daughter of immigrants. Her connection to immigrant rights work is personal.
I guess I should step back a little bit and spell out a little more what social movement lawyering is. It's this idea that lawyers, judges, courts, they're not going to save us, right? Their courts are not on the front lines of social, cultural, and legal change. And I think acknowledging that, you know, the law will always be an important terrain of struggle, I think it's important we fight on this terrain with crystal clear precision about the limitations and the biases baked into the law. I believe, and I think that history has shown us, that social change occurs when everyday people, workers, tenants, mothers, students, like directly impacted people, they build and lead movements for racial and economic justice. You know, movements like the Movement for Black Lives, Standing Rock, Me Too, Not One More, right? So it's about power, right? And it's about shifting power relations that gets at the root causes of oppression. And so like there's this growing sector of lawyers and legal organizations who are using their skills to build the power of social movements. And so, you know, instead of viewing themselves as saviors, these lawyers see themselves as really the scaffolding under the feet of, you know, these collectives of organizing people. And so the lawyers creatively use legal tools, you know, to help these organizers build the power, right? And to make the space for, to validate, to bolster, to defend and protect social movements and the activists and the communities within them. Like, we really think this allows lawyers to have a much larger impact.
In the past 3 years, both Ninaj and Sejal have been involved in the struggle to keep temporary protected status, TPS, from expiring for the more than 50,000 Haitian nationals who applied for and received the status after the devastating earthquake of 2010.
So temporary protected status, often referred to as TPS, is a form of humanitarian immigration relief that allows individuals from designated countries to live and work lawfully in the United States when they can't safely return to their country of origin because of armed conflict, because of natural disaster, or some other extraordinary circumstances. And so since President Trump took office, the administration has terminated TPS designations for 6 countries, including Haiti, in an unlawful attempt to deport close to 300,000 immigrants of color. And in Haiti's case, the termination of TPS affects the lives of over 50,000 Haitian nationals, many of whom have lived in the United States for more than a decade, along with their 27,000 U.S. citizen children.
Internal documents revealed that the Trump administration decision to terminate TPS went against the evidence. The evidence showed that Haiti was still recovering from the 2010 earthquake, which had killed more than 200,000 people and left more than 1 million homeless. Haiti remained incapable of safely repatriating its nationals. Racism tainted, if not guided, the administration's decision to terminate TPS.
I have a lot to say about the racial animus that was inherent in the termination of TPS for Haiti. You know, and I'd start by saying that President Trump has made clear that he wishes to reduce the number of immigrants of color to the United States. And I think that the rescission of Haiti's TPS is part of that agenda. What he's referred to as his, you know, his America First platform. And former acting DHS Secretary Duke, who was the one who officially terminated Haiti's TPS, in her notes, you know, she wrote that her decision to end TPS, that it was consistent with this America First policy. And, you know, just to be clear, that slogan, the America First slogan, has been used to propagate anti-immigrant and sentiment and racial animus since the early 1900s, right? It was used prominently by the KKK, and it was associated with white supremacy. I think more specifically, and is widely known, right, Trump himself has made a number of racist statements specifically towards Haitians. In June of 2017, you know, when he learned that 15,000 Haitian people had received visas to the United States, Trump stated that Haitians all have AIDS, right? And this was a few months before Haiti's TPS was terminated. And this was said, you know, to the very advisors who would go on to recommend the termination of Haiti's TPS. A few months later, in a meeting with several U.S. senators, Trump disparaged a draft immigration plan, you know, that would have protected people from Haiti, from El Salvador, and some African countries. And, you know, he asked, why are we having all these people from shithole countries come here? And he went on to say, why do we need more Haitians? He then ordered the bill's drafters to take them out. In the same meeting, Trump expressed a preference for more immigrants from places like Norway.
Sejal and Ninaj are each involved in lawsuits to declare the termination illegal and to extend TPS for Haitian nationals. Haitian Women for Haitian Refugees is also part of the National TPS Alliance.
And so, you know, the case that we're involved in, Sejal v. Trump, it began on March 15th, 2018, when the weekly newspaper Haiti Liberté, the Family Action Network Movement, and 10 Haitian TPS beneficiaries filed a lawsuit in New York to enjoin the termination of Haiti's TPS. In early 2019, we had a four-day trial. It heard testimony from experts, former governmental officials, and plaintiffs. And the court issued a nationwide preliminary injunction against the termination of Haitian TPS, you know, meaning that termination couldn't go into effect. And the Trump administration appealed the preliminary injunction to the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which recently heard arguments. And so we're now waiting on a decision from the court, but it could be months before the Second Circuit rules. You know, and the litigation here, it complements the efforts of the TPS Advocacy Working Group, which is a coalition of hundreds of organizations that are fighting for TPS and legislative change. And they also employ, you know, a very robust communication strategy, you know, around TPS as well.
National TPS Alliance is an organization founded and led by TPS holders. They have over 60 committees throughout the country that meet regularly in Washington, D.C. and meet with legislators. But again, when we've had several conferences there with 300 TPS holders from El Salvador, Honduras, Haiti, Nepal, Nicaragua, all the 13 countries, Sudan, Somalia, all the 13 countries that hold TPS. We would have representatives there, and we would meet, again, TPS holders themselves and train and meet with the legislators and have them hear the stories of how their lives are affected and the concerns of further family separation, you know, because if TPS is terminated and they're forced to return to their countries, there are hard decisions that families would have to make to separate their families. So without the involvement of directly impacted people being forefront in these movements, I don't think they would have happened. And so I think it's really important for the litigations to work hand in hand with the grassroots movements to have a lasting change. So I feel strongly about the work that's being done and the advancement of the movement for TPS. And I think TPS holders have gained momentum and strength. It's a powerful movement. But the beauty of it is that it is led by TPS holders.
In mid-September of 2020, after the interviews with Ninaj and Sejal had been recorded, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that Trump can move forward to terminate TPS for hundreds of thousands of TPS holders from El Salvador, Nicaragua, Haiti, and Sudan. This decision is now being appealed. However, the government cannot end TPS for Haiti due to the Sage lawsuit, which Sejal is involved in. The government can only terminate TPS for Haiti if they win their challenge to the preliminary injunction. As Sejal mentioned, the case is currently in the Second Circuit Court of Appeals. The fight to save TPS continues. And in addition to supporting TPS, Ninaj has other ideas for how listeners can support current movement for Haitian immigrant rights.
Currently, there are families being held at Berks County Detention Center in Berks County, Pennsylvania. There is a coalition called Shut Down Berks Coalition in Pennsylvania that are made up of all sorts of activists, some coming from the environmental activist sector, and some are immigrant activists. Haitian Women for Haitian Refugees joined the Shut Down Berks Coalition, the Families for Freedom that are based in New York also, that was basically founded to defend folks in detention. There's a lot more digital organizing going on now because of the pandemic that we're in. So if people can't be there physically in the direct actions, they can support the organizations that can be there. And they can also do their work through their digitalized organizing efforts, through their social media, spread the word so that we can shut this place down and release these families. I mean, families shouldn't be in jail. All of our campaigns, for the most part, involve keeping families together, because that's the most detrimental effect of these poor immigration policies, that they've been separating families. So whether we're talking about TPS, we're talking about keeping families together, whether we're talking about stop the deportations to Haiti, we're talking about keeping families together. So I think in this day when many things are being done virtually, and even prior to the pandemic, there's been a lot of move to online movements. It's really important to recognize the importance of physical in-person movements too, and keep a balance of it. It's easy for anybody to sit home and start a petition and just put it out there on your social media and spread it. And it can be really effective too if it gets around to the right networks. But it's also important, you know, as I mentioned earlier, a lot of these movements really start by people physically being somewhere and making their demands. You know, when George Floyd was murdered, and even before, the movement that we've seen during this pandemic, where people have taken the streets, all kinds of people have taken the streets for the movement for Black Lives.
Sejal offers advice for law students.
If you're interested in doing social justice advocacy, one, be prepared to fail, right? Failure is an inevitable part of social justice advocacy. You know, we've brought cases that are hard, that we're prepared to lose, but where the movement gains. And so I would encourage law students, you know, not to be afraid to take those cases, to play a role in those cases, because sometimes the ones with the most risk provide the most gains.
Ninaj leaves us on a note of optimism. In recent years, she sees more lawyers showing up in the streets to join organizers and community members in protest.
That's a great thing. You know, I would show up at a protest and immigration in 2017 in front of 26 Federal Plaza, and I would see some of the lawyers that work with us in the clinic that I'd never seen in protest before. So they were really stepping over the line and becoming activists too. That's really made a difference in the work. They've pushed it. You know, I know lawyers that were working at organizations just doing legal casework and would take their vacation time and go into a detention down south and advocate for Haitian refugees to be released. So that's something that I've never seen before. I think in the end, the message is, whether you're an organizer, a lawyer, a law student, you know, all of these things have to work together, and that's what's making lasting change happen. That's what's bringing on effective change. It's litigations. They don't work alone. It has to work together with the grassroots organizing movement, the grassroots organizers, and of course, that should always be led by the directly impacted people. They should be center and front of these movements.
A huge thank you to guests Ninaj Raoul and Sejal Zota for joining us in this fifth episode of The Other Side of the Water. In episode 6, Sarah Hamilton-Jung talks with Tendai Achiume, UN Special Rapporteur on Contemporary Forms of Racism. Tendai Achiume is also a professor at UCLA School of Law. She discusses her forthcoming work, Racial Borders, in which she argues that we should see the national borders of the world today as racial technology, with white supremacy as the ordering principle. We hope you tune in for this final episode of the series. This episode was produced by Kisi Deveni of the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. It's edited by Zach McNeese. The music featured on this episode is by the Haitian band La Kumizique. The song that opens the episode is called Samba Yo Prampale and is a collaboration between La Kumizique and the DJ producer Joseph Ray. For more information about the Other Side of the Water podcast series and our conference, Immigration, Equal Protection, and the Promise of Racial Justice, The Legacy of Jean V. Nelson, please see our website, jeanvnelson35.org. Thank you for tuning in.